It's incredibly difficult to be elected president of the United States, and for good reason. Politics may shape how we feel about this, but the hope is that whoever serves as commander-in-chief will take seriously their oath to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution, and by extension, the American people. But here's the thing. Even the wisest, most honorable president has a human brain affected by stress and anxiety and exhaustion. Are we sure we want this one person and one person alone to have the power to launch a nuclear war? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Some cognitive scientists and neuroscientists think it could be helpful to really understand what is happening in the mind of anybody called upon to make such a decision, including what could lead to hasty or irrational action. Journalist Sarah Scholes is a contributor at Wired and Popular Science. Her recent article for the New York Times was titled, "Nuclear War Could End the World, But What If It's All in Our Heads?" Sarah, welcome to Think.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So for an all too brief moment in recent history, Sarah, it appeared as though the world was maybe past the most urgent threat of nuclear war. Remind us of some of the reasons this is once again the sort of catastrophe that many experts are worried about, right along with the general population.
Right. A lot of experts actually believe that the risk of a potential nuclear war, nuclear catastrophe is kind of as high right now as it was during the height of the Cold War, which is, like you said, pretty remarkable given that we kind of all thought we were past it for a while. But I think, there's a few factors that go into it. One, probably the biggest one on people's minds right now, is Russia's invasion of Ukraine. You know, Russia is a nuclear armed state, and many of the states, supporting Ukraine also have nuclear weapons. And so you have this kind of indirect confrontation going on that involves, radioactive arms. And then also kind of on a colder side of things, the US, Russia, and China are all kind of revamping their nuclear complexes, either, creating more weapons, creating new designs, modernizing these arms that have existed for a very long time. And that kind of leaves each country a little bit worried about all of the other countries. And so just the tensions are running higher right now than they have in decades.
There has been scholarly work on nuclear decision-making in the past. Most of this, though, was grounded in economic theory. What are the assumptions implicit in economic theory when you're considering big decisions?
Right. So economic theory kind of has historically relied on the idea that people are rational actors, that they make decisions in a rational way that kind of maximizes their own benefit and aren't affected by, emotions or stresses or time pressure, and just kind of will reliably make the same set of decisions given the same set of circumstances. But, anybody who's made any kind of decision knows that feelings and circumstances always play into it, and people aren't quite as predictable, as pieces on a chessboard. And so since this idea of kind of rational world leaders has taken hold in nuclear strategy, people have for a long time been saying, that's not really how people act, and we should look at how people actually act and how their brains actually work to decide how we should form nuclear policy. But it hasn't actually really translated into policy as of yet.
So scientists are hoping to continue studying this, incorporate new and better knowledge of how the brain works, I guess, especially under deep stress, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's hard to imagine a more stressful situation than deciding whether to use nuclear weapons. I personally don't have any stressors like that in my daily life. But these cognitive and neuroscientists who are interested in learning more about how the brain works in these circumstances are looking at things like, how does time pressure affect the brain and the ability to make decisions? How does the order in which people talk affect the way that people take their advice? How does the idea of hurting people in another country compare in a world leader's mind to hurting people in your own country? And I'm just kind of thinking through all of these different variables and understanding how they might affect nuclear decision making.
So if I understand correctly, in the United States, the power to decide whether or not to use nuclear weapons rests entirely with the president, although presumably any president would have advisors offering insight. What do you know about how that works in practice? Like, how many layers exist between the decision to launch a nuclear strike and the execution of that strike?
So a lot of the details of what goes on in terms of nuclear launch protocols are classified, but what we do know is that the decision to launch a nuclear weapon does rest solely with the president. It's kind of standard practice to meet with people like the Secretary of Defense and other military leaders and aides, and have the president, you know, hear about the intelligence that's coming in, hear the thoughts of these other experts, and then make a decision that is then transferred to the people who in the military who actually, you know, press the button to launch the nuclear weapon. But in actual, you know, codified fact, the president, all the president has to do is say, I would like to launch a nuclear weapon, and then it's done. They don't have to consult with anyone. They don't have to have anyone's permission. No one can say no, except if it's an illegal order, and there's not a whole lot of ways to make it an illegal order. So the layers are pretty thin, I would say.
As far as you know, is that sort of the way it works in nuclear armed states around the world?
No, not in all of them. There are other countries that have, you know, require the yes or no of another person. I don't know the details of, you know, every nuclear armed country, but there are other methods of doing this that do require, you know, somebody else to say, hey, maybe that's not a good idea.
So obviously one justification for leaving nuclear decisions entirely with the commander in chief is that the call to launch a nuclear strike might have to happen very quickly. But we should talk through, you know, the potential hazards of making any such enormous decision in haste.
Right, of course. Yeah, the idea of this time pressure kind of comes from the Cold War when the United States had, you know, it had a nuclear arsenal, but people were not sure whether it could survive an attack from another country. So, you know, the idea was that you needed to be able to launch after an attack before someone else's missiles hit you, because your missiles might not survive those other missiles. And so there was a very limited amount of time, but today that's not as true as it was in the past, as far as we understand it, that the weapons are designed to survive an attack. And so there is, you know, potentially more time to make a decision, evaluate information, and look at whether you should be launching a nuclear weapon. And I think that is, you know, particularly relevant right now in the modern world, where, as we know, there's lots of sources of misinformation, disinformation, confusion, uncertainty. Lots of things are digital. There's the potential for, you know, cybersecurity problems and just confusion about what's going on. And I think, you know, a lot of the proposals from people in the nuclear policy reform space advocate taking a little more time to make the decision, to make sure that you have the right information. And are not acting on, you know, incorrect information or incomplete information and, you know, causing World War III because of a mistake.
It's funny that this story isn't just universally known, but there have been false alarms and very close calls in 20th century history.
Yes, absolutely. And one that people like to cite that is kind of emblematic of the problems that, you know, time pressure and bad information can cause does come from the former Soviet Union and one officer named Stanislav Petrov, who was sitting at his station outside of Moscow, watching to see whether, you know, any American missiles might be coming their way. And at one point, his system said, there are American missiles coming your way. And he doubted whether that information was true. Technically, the protocol was that if he saw that, he should pass it up the chain. And that would very likely have triggered the Soviet Union to launch their own missiles toward the U.S. But he did not pass it up the chain because he wasn't sure it was true. And he actually feared starting a nuclear war more than he feared, you know, being wrong and having the Soviet Union be bombed without retaliating. And so he did not pass the information up the chain. And it turned out that that was the right thing to do because it was a false alarm caused actually by, I believe, sunlight reflecting off the clouds in a particular way that confused the computer system and looked like missiles coming toward the Soviet Union. And so, you know, we all have Petrov to thank for being here, probably.
In the event of a situation that looked like it might call for a nuclear action or response, I mean, there are also group dynamics to think about, right? Potentially, presidential advisors would play a key role in convincing a president to pursue or refrain from a nuclear strike. Are the brain scientists looking at potential protocols to suggest, are they looking at how these kinds of conversations might play out?
Yeah, and one of the things they're looking at in particular is that when the president meets with the Secretary of Defense and other leaders, thinking about the order in which those people give advice so that there is room for different opinions and dissenting opinions. Because if you say, let's say you start with the president's opinion and then kind of go down the hierarchical chain, people lower down are more likely to just agree with what the people above them said rather than, you know, saying their true opinions. And so some of the proposals call for the lowest person on the totem pole to speak first so that they speak more freely. And there are also concerns of, you know, political party and affiliation and loyalty and whether that might play in to the way that people respond. I don't know of any particular proposals for dealing with that, but you're right. In any case where the president doesn't just decide, I on my own am going to launch nuclear weapons, group dynamics absolutely come into play.
I mean, just what we've talked about already, I think drives home the point that possessing nuclear weapons at all creates a lot of conundrums that cannot be easily solved. I mean, you want to possess them and hope never to use them, but they're always there in the back of leaders' minds, aren't they?
Right. Yeah, it's easier for us, you know, the people who do not have control of nuclear weapons, to kind of forget about them, even when, you know, there are lots of global tensions in the air right now. But when any country with nuclear weapons interacts with another country, the existence of those nuclear weapons is part of that interaction. And, you know, the idea behind modern nuclear strategy relies on something called deterrence, which is basically using the threat of your own nuclear weapons to stop another country from doing something you don't want, like attacking you or using a nuclear weapon on you. And so this threat theoretically keeps large-scale conflict from breaking out, although, you know, no one knows for sure if that is true or will be true forever. But the tricky thing about deterrence is that for it to work, it requires you to be willing to actually use the nuclear weapons. So they exist with the hope that you will never use them and that their existence will stop other people from using them, but it relies on your willingness to use them. So it's kind of this vicious circle sort of thing.
Sarah, what did you learn about the unusual amount of anxiety among high-level leaders and advisors during the presidency of Donald Trump?
Well, I think the presidency of Donald Trump was maybe the first time that it really came into public consciousness, the fact that the president was the only person who could launch nuclear weapons and that you know, he could do it by himself. And it became a talking point among the, you know, the people in political power that the commander-in-chief was Donald Trump and had this authority. And some people, such as Speaker Nancy Pelosi, sought to limit that power because it was concerning. And I think that, you know, from the outside, It was the first time that a lot of people in the United States realized that that was the case, that the president could wake up one day and decide to launch nuclear weapons. And I think it brought about a public conversation that then played out as a political conversation also.
I mean, the former president was well known for his bluster as well as his belligerence. Did the people around him spend a lot of time considering, like, how seriously they would take his rhetoric if he started talking about launching a nuclear strike?
I mean, I don't know the details of their specific conversations about that, but I do know that there were times, at least one time, when the president, you know, talked about the idea of using nuclear weapons in a first strike. And whether that was possible, and that people around him over the course of his presidency talked to themselves about whether it was possible to limit his power. And I think that the important thing to the brain scientists studying this topic is not necessarily any one president in particular, although, you know, some presidents may be more concerning than others, but just the fact that any one human being, no matter who they are, has this amount of power. And do we as citizens want it to be that way? And from a brain science perspective, like, is it responsible for it to be that way?
What has brain science in recent years shown us about the way human cognition is affected by a sense of imminent catastrophe?
Right. Well, I think some of the important research about the brain and catastrophe is that it cannot pay attention to, you know, everything all at once, which I'm sure, you know, anyone just doing their job or going about their lives has noticed. You can only take in so much information. And in a catastrophe, particularly one involving lots of countries and lots of nuclear weapons, there's a lot of information. And so you can't take it all into account as one individual person. And I think another thing is that because of that phenomenon, a president or anyone making a decision chooses to focus on one or a few very prominent variables. Like the one that researchers pointed out to me was that in the context of a president and nuclear weapons, they would probably focus on, you know, the security of the American people over, you know, the possibility of foreign lives that were being lost. And so just you can't hold everything equally in your brain. And so what do you do when you're tasked with, you know, essentially the fate of the world?
It sounds like you're saying presidents might not in the moment pay much attention at all to the possibility of just vast amounts of innocent civilian casualties from even the most targeted nuclear strike.
Yeah, I don't know that I would say they would not pay any attention at all exactly, but there's a concept that psychologists talk about called psychic numbing, which is the idea that, you know, no matter who you are, no matter how compassionate you are, it's basically psychologically impossible to truly understand what, you know, 10,000, 100,000, a million deaths somewhere means. And that's just the way the human brain works. Like we cannot physically fully understand what that means. And so then when faced with this concept that we can't fully grasp, and, you know, protecting your own country comes to prominence, perhaps more than the civilians in another country.
Who is Dr. Moran Cerf? Or maybe I'm saying that name wrong.
No, I think you're saying it correctly. He is a neuroscientist and professor at Columbia University who is helping lead a project with a nonprofit organization called the Nuclear Threat Initiative. This is a program funded by the Carnegie Corporation to apply some of this modern brain science to nuclear launch protocols. And so he has a background both in neuroscience and philosophy. He studied consciousness. He's been a hacker. He's kind of all over the place, but he, a few years ago, became very alarmed at this idea that one single person was in charge of the launch of nuclear weapons and decided to apply, his doctoral skills in cognitive and neuroscience to nuclear launch protocols.
So his dream is to put an actual president into some kind of brain scanning machine and see how that individual's brain is working. I mean, that's not going to happen, right? Presidents have a lot going on. They are not available to submit to this kind of testing. Is it possible to do this sort of testing on lower level decision makers? I mean, how do you approximate a president of the United States making a nuclear launch decision in a lab setting?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. The president is unlikely to step into an fMRI machine and have their decision making evaluated for various reasons. But I know that one thing that Dr. Cerf and his group have done is taken a lot of just regular people and kind of put them into a simulation of, you are the president. These things are happening in the world. Do you decide to launch a nuclear weapon or not? And so kind of taking the range of different people's responses and trying to understand like what goes into how people make a decision so that we can better understand, what might lead a president to make the decision to launch a nuclear weapon.
There are even some interesting questions about people's willingness to, say, wager money when they consider a problem like climate change. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, this is one of Dr. Cerf's papers that he's done as part of this research with the Nuclear Threat Initiative. And he found that one way to both change people's minds and evaluate their thinking on a topic is to ask them to make bets on the topic, and the topic of the research paper that he did was climate change. And so he asked people to make bets on things like, will there be more and worse wildfires this season, which sometimes is a measure of how the climate is changing. And he found that when money was at stake, even people who did not believe that climate change was real would start betting in favor of outcomes about climate change. And so that was the gist of the paper, that you can change your own mind, if you have money at stake. And the idea is that you could use maybe nuclear betting to get people to care about nuclear topics more and think about them more in the future, but that also you could play this game with people who were in military positions of power or advising the president and kind of understand how they were thinking about the nuclear future.
So presumably betting decisions are still based on our kind of rational calculations about how things might play out. Dr. Cerf also worries that assumptions that every president's choice will be entirely rational are naive, right? We can't assume there's no possibility that emotion will play a part in these decisions.
Right. I think Dr. Cerf said this, and also Joan Rolfing, who is at the head of the Nuclear Threat Initiative, pointed out to me when I was working on the article that, we kind of accept that as normal and true for any other kind of decision. Like, even if you're choosing, what to have for lunch or whether to stay in a relationship or what kind of car to buy, in general, you're not just making a strictly checklist rational set of decisions. Like, your feelings, your background, your personal emotions, what kind of a day you're having that day, whether you're hungry, whether you got enough sleep, all of that plays into the way that we interact with the world in general. And so it's very naive to think that in the highest stakes situation possible, a nuclear launch scenario, that all of those things wouldn't also play in. And I think that idea is actually why Dr. Cerf and the Nuclear Threat Initiative and lots of people in the nuclear space advocate that one person should not be in charge of this, because then, their individual psychology has such a large role in the fate of the world. And maybe it's better to have a few more people's individual psychology also playing into that.
Are leaders asking for this kind of guidance? Are they asking for new protocols from brain scientists?
I don't, have direct insight into the rooms where those kinds of conversations happen, unfortunately. But as far as I know, no one has directly asked for these recommendations, although there does seem to be some interest within government in learning about it. There is the possibility of changing protocols. Like, they have not been static throughout all of history and are just, you know, our own human making. So it's possible to change them. But the actual level of interest within the government, I think, is kind of opaque from the outside still.
Do you know, are these protocols prescribed in law, or are they just sort of longstanding custom at the moment?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is a very good question that is also pretty opaque from the outside. At a baseline, you know, the president is the commander in chief and has that authority. But the, you know, nuclear weapons are not in the Constitution. So there's nothing like at that kind of base level laying out this responsibility and protocol. It's actually not law, not amendment, not constitution. It's in internal documents that are largely classified that have just kind of set this out over time. And I think the first time it was laid out that the president, excuse me, was in charge of this was 1948, which was a few years after we had nuclear weapons. And so at the beginning, it wasn't even codified in that way. Now it is, but yeah, it's not law, it's not regulation, it's internal documents that most of us do not have access to.
Sarah, it's worth noting that part of the reason presidents have this authority is that if they're thinking about launching a nuclear weapon as part of a counterattack, presumably they don't have a whole lot of time to plan and, you know, go to Congress, etc. What do we know about the way that the sense of a kind of ticking clock can affect our decision making?
Right. Well, we know that a ticking clock provides stress, which can sometimes, you know, interfere. It causes us to not be able to evaluate things in exactly probably the rational way that nuclear strategists have thought of presidents evaluating this in the past. And it also, you know, rushes the ability to go through information. In the modern world, there's a lot of information. Like, there are, you know, millions of sensors in the world that provide data about what might be going on, including whether a nuclear attack might be happening. And if you are under extreme time pressure to make a decision, it's basically impossible to fully comb through that information, see what you think of it, make sure you think it's accurate. Generally leads to people making worse decisions if there's a lot of time pressure.
Yeah, your article made me think about the fact that even for the most experienced sort of prudent leader on the planet, wherever that person may be in the United States or some other country, by definition, because no leader alive has any experience with the decision to launch a nuclear attack, this would be uncharted territory for anyone.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's uncharted territory that I wouldn't envy anyone. And I think that also makes research into, you know, how the brain works in these situations very difficult to do, because you're right, literally no one has ever been in this situation who is currently alive right now. And so every bit of research we do is kind of an approximation of the real thing. And we all know that approximations are called approximations for a reason. And so it makes it very difficult to actually predict what might happen in any given scenario.
Is there any good way to test these ideas? You know, if scholars come up with protocols that they think might lead to better decision making, how can they know if their ideas are good or just sound good?
Yeah, that is a good question and a hard one. One way that within the military, at least, people, you know, try to evaluate what might happen in a given conflict scenario is something called a war game, where people sit down, are given kind of a fictional scenario and then play it out almost like a kind of Dungeons and Dragons of World War or something like that. And so you could do something like that with new protocols. You could do something like Dr. Cerf and his group have done of putting different people into a kind of simulation and seeing what they would do. Right now, there are also things like there's an online war game for regular people to play to see how they might respond in a given scenario. And so I think just kind of triangulating between the different responses is the best thing we can do at the moment.
Sarah, I wonder if you saw the Oppenheimer movie and whether you think that movies like that, that delve into the morals of having to deal with this kind of weaponry, have the ability to influence how people think about using them, possibly even including the people who have the power to launch these weapons.
Yeah, I have seen Oppenheimer. I saw it the week it came out, and I was greatly anticipating it. And I actually do think that movies like that and popular culture that brings nuclear weapons back into the public conversation, you know, among people who are not policymakers and who don't work at think tanks and things like that, I actually think that is enormously powerful, particularly right now when, as we've talked about, nuclear weapons have such relevance to the modern world, but haven't really been a part of our consciousness for a few decades. And so just kind of bringing them back into the public sphere, you know, in the movie, you see J. Robert Oppenheimer kind of struggling with the reality of this, you know, potentially catastrophic weapon that he has brought into the world and what that means for its future. And that, you know, forces the viewers to think the same things. And even if they only think it for the, I forget how long the movie was, 3 hours or whatever it was that that they're in the theater. I think that just having a populace that is more informed about those moral questions and that they even exist and are part of our modern lives is important and powerful.
It is strange to think about any president making such a huge decision. I mean, there will always be unknowns, right? Even when a decision is relatively simple, there's no such thing as complete information.
That's true. And it's a very scary thing to have a world leader, ours or someone else's, have to make a decision based on incomplete information. And but that's likely how it will be if we're ever in that scenario.
And of course, there's the reality that this is going to sound strange, but theoretically, we could suffer a nuclear attack and decide not to launch a nuclear weapon in retaliation, whether we suffer that attack because there's an accident happening. I mean, it almost seems in certain situations, the harder decision would be not to launch a strike.
Right. Yeah. And that's something that doesn't get talked about that often. But just as the president could decide right now to launch a nuclear weapon, if they wanted to, if we were attacked, they could decide not to do it at all. Or if there was an accident, like you said, to not respond at all. And I think that's something we don't talk about enough, the possibility that we wouldn't follow through on the, you know, the horrible threat that underlies deterrence.
So what do you know about how influential these scholars might be in, if not, you know, speaking directly with the president, in speaking with people who might have the president's ear about the need to amend existing protocols?
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Changing policy is always harder than thinking about changing policy. But, you know, Dr. Cerf, the brain scientist, is collaborating with the Nuclear Threat Initiative, which is a nonprofit group that has a number of former and current, former government leaders in positions of power who are on the board or affiliated with it, including in the past, the president of the National Nuclear Security Administration, and a woman who actually helped this grant come into being, Deborah Rosenblum, is now part of an office within the government that briefs the president on nuclear matters. And so there is kind of this direct channel, or I guess two-step channel to the to the president. And I don't know, you know, myself whether that will be used, but I think, you know, they stand a better shot than a lot of groups do at actually getting their information to the right places.
We have an election season on the horizon. It's sometimes surprising to me how little these things get talked about. Do you have a sense, or do these academic studying decision-making, nuclear decision-making, have a sense of how we could ensure that we actually know what any given candidate for president believes about how they would make a decision in very difficult circumstances?
Yeah, I mean, I personally would love to ask every candidate that question myself. I mean, I think people can advocate for having that on, you know, the potential administration's platform, like what they think about these topics. And I think, you know, as voters, people can evaluate candidates, even if they don't know directly what those candidates think, on, you know, how do I think that this person would make a decision in the moment about nuclear weapons, and just making that part of your evaluation of a candidate, like, would I trust this person with the nukes? Because when you elect a president, that is in effect what you're doing.
Is there some proven way to ensure that leaders considering any kind of catastrophic attack on another country are sort of reminded to exercise empathy as they do this?
I don't know that there's a way to guarantee that. I mean, I like to think that people in power do think about, you know, the people that their decisions affect. I think, you know, ensuring, as one of the people I interviewed for this story noted, that there are civilians in addition to military leaders in the room when the president has the consultation about whether to make a nuclear launch or not, just so you have a diversity of opinions and views and experiences that might bring different concerns to light. I think that might be a good way to go about it.
It's always interesting to me to think about not simply sort of the day of the attack or the day after the attack, but what the ramifications of such a decision might be a year down the road, 10 years down the road, 50 years down the road. A nuclear attack decision is not something that is kind of over as soon as the strike happens.
No, not at all. And that's, I mean, that is one of the most devastating parts of nuclear weapons, is that their effects stay for, you know, decades, even longer. And I think that, you know, in addition to encouraging world leaders to think about the people that their, you know, potential launches of the future that hopefully don't happen might affect, is like you said, to think about the effect on the world, both, you know, in terms of the people, in terms of the environment, in terms of the global dynamics, because it's not a decision that would just go away.
Did you detect, Sarah, among the scholars who are doing this work on presidential decision making related to nuclear launches, is there kind of an implicit desire among those scientists for nuclear nonproliferation? Or do all these folks accept that it is necessary and inevitable for the United States to possess nuclear weapons?
Yeah, I can't say that I know their personal views individually, but I think that I would say in general, whether they're, you know, pro-nonproliferation, pro-disarmament entirely, they all do accept that we live in a world that right now has nuclear weapons, whatever happens to them in the future. And that if we're going to live in a world where multiple countries have nuclear weapons, how do we make that world the safest one possible, where nuclear launch is the least likely? And so I would say that that's where they're coming from. Like, if we realistically have to inhabit this world right now, how do we make it the best version of a nuclear world as possible?
Do these researchers think there's anything that can be learned from looking at the history of the attacks on Hiroshima and Nagasaki and how those decisions were made?
You know, no one spoke about those decisions to me in particular, although now that you pointed out, that is pretty strange given that it's the only time that anyone has used a nuclear weapon during a war. But I think, you know, the circumstances now are very different from the circumstances then. back then, the United States was the only country that had nuclear weapons, so there was no deterrence. There was no mutually assured destruction. It was just, we want to show you our own overwhelming power that you can't do very much about. And now we kind of have a lot of countries with that power. And so the decision to launch nuclear weapons becomes a very different one, in no small part because it likely involves a second country or a third launching nuclear weapons. But I think probably what they and we and presidents can learn from those previous attacks is, you know, is the terrible toll that they took on Japan and the people of Japan back then and continuing, you know, into the modern day, into I think it's probably worthwhile to think back on those devastating bombs anytime we think about potentially using nuclear weapons in the future, which hopefully we do not do.
Yeah, it is an enormous difference, though, when you think about the fact that the decision to drop bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I mean, there was a certain urgency because folks on the American side wanted to do this before anybody else had the capacity, but it wasn't quite the ticking clock that we imagine a president would face in some future nuclear attack.
Right, right. Yes. There was the only ticking clock was the one that we made. And I think it also becomes very different because those weapons in comparison to the ones we have now, they were extremely devastating on their own. And the weapons that we have and are capable of building across the world right now are enormously more powerful than those were. And so that is something also to keep in mind.
Were the scientists you talked to able to share anything like a developing set of protocols that they would offer to a president for making these decisions? Like, what would they add into that sort of chain of action that maybe doesn't exist now?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're still working on the details of how their science actually translates to protocol changes. So I don't have that directly, but the one thing that they and also the outside researchers they spoke to all agree on is that they think that there should be, you know, one or two more people in the chain of command who have a say in whether nuclear weapons get used or not, which, you know, that doesn't even necessarily need to have all of the brain science behind it. It's just kind of something a lot of people agree on, is that it would be better if there were at least one other person who had to say yes or could say no with their own brain.
Do these scientists have the sense that once their recommendations are complete and ready for release, that anybody in power will pay attention to them?
Yeah, I think that they are hopeful about that. And I mean, it is kind of, it does happen in scholarly work that the scholarly work, you know, stays within the academy or a world where it has no effect on what's going on in the world outside. But I know that they plan to at least try to get it into the hands of the people in power.
I will say finally, your article made me think about the fact that, you know, we all go through our lives understanding for the most part that the president does have this unitary power to launch a nuclear strike. Somehow, it's almost like we have to not think very much about that in order to just go through life and not be thinking about it all the time.
Yeah, there was someone who I've interviewed, not for this piece, but for a different one. His job is actually to try to quantify the nuclear arsenals of every country in the world and just keep tabs on what everyone is doing. And I asked him, you know, what is it like to have to think about that every day for that to be your work, to kind of quantify this potential destruction? And he said, oh, I just completely dissociate. And I think that is probably what all of us do to some extent, in part because it is outside of our power, like whether there is a nuclear war or not, we have essentially no say in. And so when you have no control, just completely dissociate is one way of going about coping.
Science writer Sarah Scholes is a contributor at Wired and Popular Science. Her recent article for the New York Times was titled, Nuclear War Could End the World, But What If It's All in Our Heads? Sarah, thanks so much for making time to talk about this.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
You can find us on Facebook and Instagram and subscribe to the podcast wherever you like to get podcasts, or catch it right at our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.